The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 1, Continued. Cassette 2, Side 2.
As we begin to understand our judicial practices, we realize now that the public trials were only the surface indications of the mole's tunnel, and that all the main digging lay beneath the surface. At these trials, only a small number of those arrested were produced in court. Only those who agreed to the unnatural practice of accusing themselves and others in the hope of getting off more easily. The majority of the engineers, who had the courage and intelligence to reject and refute the interrogator's stupidities, were tried out of earshot. But even though they did not confess, they got the same tenors from the collegium of the GPU. The waves flowed underground through the pipes. They provided sewage disposal for the life flowering on the surface. It was precisely at this moment that an important step was taken toward universal participation in sewage disposal, universal distribution of responsibility for it. Those who had not yet been swept bodily down the sewer hatches, who had not yet been carried through the pipes to the archipelago, had to march up above, carrying banners praising the trials and rejoicing at the judicial reprisals. And this was very far-sighted. Decades would pass, and history would have its eyes opened. But the interrogators, judges, and prosecutors would turn out to be no more guilty than you and I, fellow citizens. The reason we possess our worthy grey heads is that in our time we worthily voted for. Stalin carried out the first such effort in connection with the trial of the famine organizers, and how could it not succeed when everyone was starving in bounteous Russia, and everyone was always looking about and asking, where did all our dear bread get to? Therefore, before the court verdict, the workers and employees wrathfully voted for the death penalty for the scoundrels on trial. And by the time of the Prompati trial, there were universal meetings and demonstrations, including even schoolchildren. It was the newspaper march of millions, and the roar rose outside the windows of the courtroom, "Death! Death! Death!" At this turning point in our history, there were some lonely voices of protest or abstention, and very, very great bravery was required to say no in the midst of that roaring chorus of approval. It is incomparably easier today. Yet even today, people don't very often vote against. To the extent that we know about them, it was those same spineless, slushy intellectuals. At the meeting of the Leningrad Polytechnic Institute, Professor Dmitry Apollinarievich Rozhensky abstained. He was an enemy of capital punishment in general, you see. In the language of science, you see, this was an irreversible process. And he was arrested then and there. The student, Dima Ulitsky, abstained and was arrested then and there. Thus, all these protests were silenced at the very source. So far as we know, the grey-moustached working class approved these executions. So far as we know, from the blazing Komsomols right up to the party leaders and the legendary army commanders, the entire vanguard waxed unanimous in approving these executions. Famous revolutionaries, theoreticians and prophets, 7 years before their own inglorious destruction, welcome the roar of the crowd, not guessing then that their own time stood on the threshold, that soon their own names would be dragged down in that roar of scum, filth. In fact, for the engineers, the rout soon came to an end. At the beginning of 1931, Yosif Vissarionovich spake his 6 conditions for construction, and his autocracy vouchsafed as the 5th condition. We must move from a policy of destruction of the old technical intelligentsia to a policy of concern for it, of making use of it. Concern for it? What has happened in the meantime to our just wrath? Where had all our terrible accusations gone to? At this very moment, as it happened, a trial of wreckers in the porcelain industry was underway. They had been playing their filthy tricks even there. All the defendants had damned each other in unison and confessed to everything. And suddenly they cried out in unison again, "We are innocent." And they were freed. There was even a small reverse wave to be remarked in this particular year. Some engineers who had already been sentenced or put under interrogation were released. Thus, D.A. Rozhansky came back. Should we not say he had won his duel with Stalin? And that if people had been heroic in exercising their civil responsibilities, there would never have been any reason to write either this chapter or this whole book. That same year, Stalin was still engaged in grinding beneath his hoof the long-since prostrate Mensheviks. There was a public trial in March 1931 of the All-Union Bureau of Mensheviks, Groman, Sukhanov, and Yakubovich, and a certain number of small, scattered, unannounced arrests took place in addition. The Sukhanov referred to here was the same Sukhanov in whose apartment on the Karpovka in Petrograd, and with whose knowledge, and the guides there nowadays are lying when they say it was without his knowledge, the Bolshevik Central Committee met on October the 10th, 1917, and adopted its decision to launch an armed uprising. And suddenly, Stalin reconsidered. The White Sea, folk say, of the tide, the water reconsiders, meaning the moment just before it begins to fall. Well, of course, it is inappropriate to compare the murky soul of Stalin with the water of the White Sea. And perhaps he didn't reconsider anything whatever. Nor was there any ebb tide. But one more miracle happened that year. In 1931, following the trial of the Promparty, a grandiose trial of the Working Peasants' Party was being prepared on the grounds that they existed, never an actual fact, as an enormous organized underground force among the rural intelligentsia, including leaders of consumer and agricultural cooperatives and the more advanced upper layer of the peasantry, and supposedly were preparing to overthrow the dictatorship of the proletariat. At the trial of the Promparty, this Working Peasants' Party, the TKP, was referred to as if it were already well known and under detention. The interrogation apparatus of the GPU was working flawlessly. Thousands of defendants had already fully confessed their adherence to the TKP and participation in its criminal plans. And no less than 200,000 members altogether were promised by the GPU. Mentioned as heading the party were the agricultural economist Alexander Vasilievich Chayanov, the future Prime Minister N.D. Kondratyev, Elen Yurovsky, Makarov, and Alexei Doyarenko, a professor from the Timiryazev Academy, future Minister of Agriculture. He might well have been a better one than those who held the job for the next 40 years, but how strange is human fate. As a matter of principle, Doyarenko was always non-political. When his daughter used to bring home fellow students who expressed opinions savoring of socialist revolutionary views, he made them leave. Then, all of a sudden, one lovely night, Stalin reconsidered. Why? Maybe we will never know. Did he perhaps wish to save his soul? Too soon for that, it would seem. Did his sense of humor come to the fore? Was it all so deadly, monotonous, so bitter-tasting? But no one would ever dare accuse Stalin of having a sense of humour. Likeliest of all, Stalin simply figured out that the whole countryside, not just 200,000 people, would soon die of famine anyway, so why go to the trouble? And instantly the whole TKP trial was called off. All those who had confessed were told they could repudiate their confessions. One can picture their happiness. And instead of the whole big catch, only the small group of Kondratyev and Chayanov was hauled in and tried. Kondratyev, sentenced to solitary confinement, became mentally ill there and died. Yurovsky also died. Chayanov was exiled to Alma-Ata after 5 years in solitary and was arrested again there in 1948. In 1941, the charge against the tortured Vavilov was that the TKP had existed and he had been its head. Paragraph piles on paragraph, year on year, and yet there is no way we can describe in sequence everything that took place. But the GPU did its job effectively. The GPU never let anything get by. But we must always remember that religious believers, of course, were being arrested uninterruptedly. There were, nonetheless, certain special dates and peak periods. There was a night of struggle against religion in Leningrad on Christmas Eve 1929, when they arrested a large part of the religious intelligentsia and held them not just until morning either. And that was certainly no Christmas tale. Then in February 1932, again in Leningrad, many churches were closed simultaneously, while at the same time large-scale arrests were made among the clergy. And there are still more dates and places, but they haven't been reported to us by anyone. Non-Orthodox sects were also under constant attack, even those sympathetic to communism. Thus, in 1929, they arrested every last member of the communes between Sochi and Kosta. These communes ran everything, both production and distribution, on a communist basis. And it was all done fairly and honestly, in a way the rest of the country won't achieve in 100 years. But, alas, they were too literate. They were well read in religious literature. And atheism was not their philosophy, which combined Baptist and Tolstoyan beliefs with those of yoga. It appeared that such a commune was criminal and that it could not bring people happiness. In the 20s, a large group of Tolstoyans was exiled to the foothills of the Altai, and there they established communal settlements jointly with the Baptists. When the construction of the Kuznetsk industrial complex began, they supplied it with food products. Then arrests began. First the teachers. They were not teaching in accordance with the government programs. And the children ran after the cars, shouting. And after that, the commune leaders were taken. The big solitaire game played with the socialists went on and on, uninterruptedly, of course. In 1929, also, those historians who had not been sent abroad in time were arrested. Platonov, Tyler, Lyubavsky, Gotyi, Lekachev, Ismailov, and the outstanding literary scholar M.M. Bakhtin. From one end of the country to the other, nationalities kept pouring in. The Yakuts were imprisoned after the revolt of 1928. The Buryat Mongols were imprisoned after the uprising of 1929, and they say about 35,000 were shot, a figure it has been impossible to verify. The Kazakhs were imprisoned after Budeni's cavalry heroically crushed their revolt in 1930 and 1931. The Union for Liberation of the Ukraine was put on trial at the beginning of 1930. Professor Yefremov, Tchaikovsky, Nikovsky, etc. And knowing the ratio in our country of what is public to what is secret, how many others followed in their footsteps? How many were secretly arrested? Then came the time, slowly it is true but surely, when it was the turn of the members of the ruling party to do time in prison. At first, from 1927 to 1929, it was a question of the workers' opposition, in other words, the Trotskyites, who had chosen themselves such an unsuccessful leader. They numbered hundreds at the start. Soon there would be thousands. But it's the first step that's the hardest. Just as these Trotskyites had observed with approval the arrest of members of other parties, so the rest of the party now watched approvingly as the Trotskyites were arrested. But everyone would have his turn. The non-existent rightist opposition would come later, and limb by limb, beginning with its own tail, the ravenous maw would devour itself, right up to its head. From 1928 on, it was time to call to a reckoning those late stragglers after the bourgeoisie, the NEP men. The usual practice was to impose on them ever-increasing and finally totally intolerable taxes. At a certain point, they could no longer pay. They were immediately arrested for bankruptcy, and their property was confiscated. Small tradesmen, such as barbers, tailors, even those who repaired Primus stoves, were only deprived of their licenses to ply their trade. There was an economic purpose to the development of the NEP men wave. The state needed property and gold, and there was as yet no Kolyma. The famous gold fever began at the end of 1929. Only the fever gripped not those looking for gold, but those from whom it was being shaken loose. The particular feature of this new gold wave was that the GPU was not actually accusing these rabbits of anything, and was perfectly willing not to send them off to Gulag country, but wished only to take away their gold by main force. So the prisons were packed, the interrogators were worn to a frazzle, but the transit prisons, prisoner transports and camps received only relatively minor reinforcements. Who was arrested in the gold wave? all those who at one time or another, 15 years before, had had a private business, had been involved in retail trade, had earned wages at a craft, and could have, according to the GPU's deductions, hoarded gold. But it so happened that they often had no gold. They had put their money into real estate or securities, which had melted away or been taken away in the revolution, and nothing remained. They had high hopes, of course, in arresting dental technicians, jewelers, and watch repairmen. Through denunciations, one could learn about gold in the most unexpected places. A veteran lathe worker had somewhere gotten hold of and held on to 60 gold 5-ruble pieces from Tsarist times. The famous Siberian partisan Muraviev had come to Odessa, bringing with him a small bag full of gold. The Petersburg Tatar draymen all had gold hidden away. Whether or not these things were so could be discovered only inside prison walls. Nothing, neither proletarian origin nor revolutionary services, served as a defense against a gold denunciation. All were arrested, all were crammed into GPU cells in numbers no one had considered possible up to then, but that was all to the good. They would cough it up all the sooner. It even reached a point of such confusion that men and women were imprisoned in the same cells and used the latrine bucket in each other's presence. Who cared about those niceties? Give up your gold, vipers! The interrogators did not write up charge sheets because no one needed their papers, and whether or not a sentence would be pasted on was of very little interest. Only one thing was important. Give up your gold, viper. The state needs gold, and you don't. The interrogators had neither voice nor strength left to threaten and torture. They had one universal method. Feed the prisoners nothing but salty food and give them no water. Whoever coughed up gold got water. One gold piece for a cup of fresh water. People perish for cold metal. This wave was distinguished from those that preceded and followed it because, even though fewer than half its victims held their fate in their own hands, some did. If you in fact had no gold, then your situation was hopeless. You would be beaten, burned, tortured, and steamed to the point of death, or until they finally came to believe you. But if you had gold, you could determine the extent of your torture, the limits of your endurance, and your own fate. Psychologically, this situation was, incidentally, not easier but more difficult. Because if you made an error, you would always be ridden by a guilty conscience. Of course, anyone who had already mastered the rules of the institution would yield and give up his gold. That was easier. But it was a mistake to give it up too readily. They would refuse to believe you had coughed it all up, and they would continue to hold you. But you'd be wrong, too, to wait too long before yielding. You'd end up kicking the bucket, or they'd paste a term on you out of meanness. One of the Tatar draymen endured all the tortures. He had no gold. They imprisoned his wife, too, and tortured her, but the Tatar stuck to his story. No gold. Then they arrested his daughter. The Tatar couldn't take it any more. He coughed up 100,000 rubles. At this point, they let his family go, but slapped a prison term on him. The crudest detective stories and operas about brigands were played out in real life on a vast national scale. The introduction of the passport system on the threshold of the 30s also provided the camps with a good-sized draft of reinforcements. Just as Peter I simplified the social structure, sweeping clean all the nooks and crannies of the old Russian class system, so our socialist passport system swept out, in particular, the betwixt and between insects. It hit at the clever, homeless portion of the population, which wasn't tied down to anything. In the early stages, people made many mistakes with those passports, and those not registered at their places of residence, and those not registered as having left their former places of residence, were raked into the archipelago, if only for a single year. And so the waves foamed and rolled, but over them all, in 1929 to 1930, billowed and gushed the multi-million wave of dispossessed kulaks. It was immeasurably large, and it would certainly not have been housed in even the highly developed network of Soviet interrogation prisons, which in any case were packed full by the gold wave. Instead, it bypassed the prisons, going directly to the transit prisons and camps, onto prisoner transports into the Gulag country. In sheer size, this non-recurring tidal wave, it was an ocean, swelled beyond the bounds of anything the penal system of even an immense state can permit itself. There was nothing to be compared with it in all Russian history. It was the forced resettlement of a whole people, an ethnic catastrophe. But yet so cleverly were the channels of the GPU Gulag organized that the cities would have noticed nothing had they not been stricken by a strange 3-year famine, a famine that came about without drought and without war. This wave was also distinct from all those which preceded it, because no one fussed about with taking the head of the family first and then working out what to do with the rest of the family. On the contrary, in this wave they burned out whole nests, whole families, from the start. And they watched jealously to be sure that none of the children, 14, 10, even 6 years old, got away. To the last scrapings, all had to go down the same road, to the same common destruction. This was the first such experiment, at least in modern history. It was subsequently repeated by Hitler with the Jews, and again by Stalin with nationalities which were disloyal to him or suspected by him. This wave included only pathetically few of those kulaks for whom it was named, in order to draw the wool over people's eyes. In Russian, a kulak is a miserly, dishonest rural trader who grows rich not by his own labor, but through someone else's, through usury and operating as a middleman. In every locality, even before the revolution, such kulaks could be numbered on one's fingers, and the revolution totally destroyed their basis of activity. Subsequently, after 1917, by a transfer of meaning, the name kulak began to be applied, in official and propaganda literature, whence it moved into general usage, to all those who in any way hired workers, even if it was only when they were temporarily short of working hands in their own families. But we must keep in mind that after the revolution it was impossible to pay less than a fair wage for all such labor. The committees of the poor and the village Soviets looked after the interests of landless laborers. Just let somebody try to swindle a landless laborer. To this very day, in fact, the hiring of labor at a fair wage is permitted in the Soviet Union. But the inflation of this scathing term kulak proceeded relentlessly. And by 1930, all strong peasants in general were being so called, all peasants strong in management, strong in work, or even strong merely in convictions. The term kulak was used to smash the strength of the peasantry. Let us remember, let us open our eyes. Only a dozen years had passed since the great decree on the land. That very decree, without which the peasants would have refused to follow the Bolsheviks, and without which the October Revolution would have failed. The land was allocated in accordance with the number of mouths per family, equally. It had been only 9 years since the men of the peasantry had returned from the Red Army and rushed onto the land they had wrested for themselves. Then, suddenly, there were kulaks, and there were poor peasants. How could that be? Sometimes it was the result of differences in initial stock and equipment. Sometimes it may have resulted from luck in the mixture of the family. But wasn't it most often a matter of hard work and persistence? And now these peasants, whose bread grain had fed Russia in 1928, were hastily uprooted by local good-for-nothings and city people sent in from outside. Like raging beasts, abandoning every concept of humanity, abandoning all humane principles which had evolved through the millennia, they began to round up the very best farmers and their families and to drive them, stripped of their possessions, naked into the northern wastes, into the tundra and the taiga. Such a mass movement could not help but develop subsequent ramifications. It became necessary to rid the villages also of those peasants who had merely manifested an aversion to joining the collective farms, or an absence of inclination for the collective life which they had never seen with their own eyes, about which they knew nothing, and which they suspected, we know now how well-founded their suspicions were, would mean a life of forced labor and famine under the leadership of loafers. Then it was also necessary to get rid of those peasants, some of them not at all prosperous, who, because of their daring, their physical strength, their determination, their outspokenness at meetings, and their love of justice, were favourites with their fellow villagers, and by virtue of their independence were therefore dangerous to the leadership of the collective farm. This kind of peasant and his fate were portrayed immortally in the character of Stepan Trousov in S. Zalikin's novel. Beyond this, in every village there were people who in one way or another had personally gotten in the way of the local activists. This was the perfect time to settle accounts with them of jealousy, envy, insult. A new word was needed for all these new victims as a class, and it was born. By this time it had no social or economic content whatsoever, but had a marvellous sound, podkulachnik, a person aiding the kulaks. In other words, I consider you an accomplice of the enemy, and that finishes you. The most tattered, landless labourer in the countryside could quite easily be labelled a podkulachnik. I remember very well that in our youth this term seemed quite logical. There was nothing in the least unclear about it. And so it was that these two terms embraced everything that constituted the essence of the village, its energy, its keenness of wit, its love of hard work, its resistance, and its conscience. They were torn up by the roots, and collectivization was accomplished. But new waves rolled from the collectivized villages. One of them was a wave of agricultural wreckers. Everywhere they began to discover wrecker agronomists, who up until that year had worked honestly all their lives, but who now purposely sowed weeds in Russian fields, on the instructions, of course, of the Moscow Institute, which had now been totally exposed. Indeed, there were those same 200,000 unarrested members of the Working Peasants' Party, the TKP. Certain agronomists failed to put into effect the profound instructions of Lysenko, and in one such wave in 1931, Lork, the so-called king of the potato, was sent to Kazakhstan. Others carried out the Lysenko directives too precisely, and thus exposed their absurdity. In 1934, Pskov agronomists sowed flax on the snow, exactly as Lysenko had ordered. The seeds swelled up, grew mouldy, and died. The big fields lay empty for a year. Lysenko could not say that the snow was a kulak, or that he himself was an ass. He accused the agronomists of being kulaks and of distorting his technology. And the agronomists went off to Siberia. Beyond all this, in almost every machine and tractor station, wrecking in the repairing of tractors was discovered. And that is how the failures of the first collective farm years were explained. There was a wave for harvest losses, losses in comparison with the arbitrary harvest figures announced the preceding spring by the Commission for Determination of the Harvest. There was a wave for failure to fulfill obligations undertaken for delivery to the state of bread grains. The district party committee had undertaken the obligation, and the collective farm had not fulfilled it. Go to prison. There was a wave for snipping ears, the night-time snipping of individual ears of grain in the field, a totally new type of agricultural activity, a new type of harvesting. The wave of those caught doing this was not small. It included many tens of thousands of peasants, many of them not even adults, but boys, girls, and small children whose elders had sent them out at night to snip, because they had no hope of receiving anything from the collective farm for their daytime labour. For this bitter and not very productive occupation, an extreme of poverty to which the peasants had not been driven even in serfdom, the courts handed out a full measure, 10 years, for what ranked as an especially dangerous theft of socialist property under the notorious law of August 7, 1932, which in prisoners' lingo was known simply as the Law of 7/8. This Law of 7/8 produced another big separate wave from the construction projects of the first and second five-year plans, from transport, trade, and industry. Big thefts were turned over to the NKVD. This wave must further be kept in mind as one that kept on flowing steadily for the next 15 years, until 1947, especially during the war years. Then, in 1947, the original law was expanded and made more harsh. Now, at last, we can catch our breath. Now, at last, all the mass waves are coming to an end. Comrade Molotov said on May the 17th, 1933, "We do not see our task as being mass repressions." Phew! At last! Begone, nighttime fears. But what's that dog howling out there? Go get him. Go get him. And here we are. The Kirov wave from Leningrad has begun. While it lasted, the tension was acknowledged to be so great that special staffs of the NKVD were set up in each and every district executive committee of the city, and an accelerated judicial procedure was introduced. Even earlier, it had not been famous for being slow, and there was no right of appeal. There had been no appeal earlier. It is also believed that one quarter of Leningrad was purged, cleaned out, in 1934 to 1935. Let this estimate be disproved by those who have the exact statistics and are willing to publish them. To be sure, this wave took in much more than Leningrad alone. It had a substantial impact on the rest of the country in a form that was consistent, though chaotic. The firing from the civil service of all those still left there, whose fathers had been priests, all former noble women, and all persons having relatives abroad. Among such lashing waves as this, certain modest, changeless wavelets always got lost. They were little heard of, but they too kept flowing on and on. There were Schutzbündlers, who had lost the class battles in Vienna and had come to the fatherland of the world proletariat for refuge. There were Esperantists, a harmful group which Stalin undertook to smoke out during the years when Hitler was doing the same thing. There were the unliquidated remnants of the Free Philosophic Society, illegal philosophical circles. There were teachers who disagreed with the advanced laboratory team system of instruction. In 1933, for instance, Natalia Ivanovna Bogayenko was arrested by the Rostov GPU, but in the third month of her interrogation, a government decree suddenly announced that the system was a faulty one, and she was let go. There were employees of the political Red Cross, which, through the efforts of Yekaterina Peshkova, was still defending its existence. There were mountain tribes of the North Caucasus who were arrested for their 1935 revolt, and non-Russian nationalities kept rolling in from one area, then another. On the Volga Canal, construction site newspapers were published in four national languages, Tatar, Turkish, Uzbek, and Kazakh. And, of course, there were readers to read them. There were once again believers who this time were unwilling to work on Sundays. They had introduced the 5- and 6-day week. And there were collective farmers sent up for sabotage because they refused to work on religious feast days, as had been their custom in the era of individual farms. And always there were those who refused to become NKVD informers. Among them were priests who refused to violate the secrecy of the confessional, for the organs had very quickly discovered how useful it was to learn the content of confessions, the only use they found for religion. And members of non-orthodox sects were arrested on an ever wider scale. And the big solitaire game with the socialists went on and on. And last of all, there was a category I have not yet named, a wave that was continually flowing. Section 10, also known as KRA, Counter-Revolutionary Agitation, and also known as ASA, Anti-Soviet Agitation. The wave of Section 10 was perhaps the most constant of all. It never stopped. And whenever there was another big wave, as for instance in 1937, 1945, and 1949, its waters became particularly swollen. This particular unremitting wave grabbed up anyone at all at any moment. But when it came to outstanding intellectuals in the 30s, they sometimes considered it cleverer to fabricate a case based on some conspicuously shameful violation, like pederasty, or in the case of Professor Pletnev, the allegation that, left alone with a woman patient, he bit her breast. A national newspaper reports such an incident, and just try to deny it. Paradoxically enough, every act of the all-penetrating, eternally wakeful organs over a span of many years, was based solely on one article of the 140 articles of the Non-General Division of the Criminal Code of 1926. One can find more epithets in praise of this article than Turgenev once assembled to praise the Russian language, or Nekrasov to praise Mother Russia. Great, powerful, abundant, highly ramified, multiform, wide-sweeping 58, which summed up the world not so much through the exact terms of its sections as in their extended dialectical interpretation. Who among us has not experienced its all-encompassing embrace? In all truth, there is no step, thought, action, or lack of action under the heavens which could not be punished by the heavy hand of Article 58. The article itself could not be worded in such broad terms, but it proved possible to interpret it this broadly. Article 58 was not in that division of the code dealing with political crimes, and nowhere was it categorized as political. No, it was included, with crimes against public order and organized gangsterism, in a division of crimes against the state. Thus, the criminal code starts off by refusing to recognize anyone under its jurisdiction as a political offender. All are simply criminals. Article 58 consisted of 14 sections. In Section 1, we learn that any action, and according to Article 6 of the Criminal Code, any absence of action, directed toward the weakening of state power, was considered to be counter-revolutionary. Broadly interpreted, this turned out to include the refusal of a prisoner in camp to work when in a state of starvation and exhaustion. This was a weakening of state power, and it was punished by execution. The execution of malingerers during the war. From 1934 on, when we were given back the term motherland, subsections were inserted on treason to the motherland, 1A, 1B, 1C, 1D. According to these subsections, all actions directed against the military might of the USSR were punishable by execution, 1B, or by 10 years imprisonment, 1A. But the lighter penalty was imposed only when mitigating circumstances were present, and upon civilians only. Broadly interpreted, when our soldiers were sentenced to only 10 years for allowing themselves to be taken prisoner, action injurious to Soviet military might, this was humanitarian to the point of being illegal. According to the Stalinist code, they should all have been shot on their return home. Here is another example of broad interpretation. I remember well an encounter in the Butyrki in the summer of 1946. A certain Pole had been born in Lemberg when that city was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Until World War II, he lived in his native city, by then located in Poland. Then he went to Austria, where he entered the service, and in 1945 he was arrested there by the Russians. Since by this time Austrian Lemberg had become Ukrainian Lvov, he received a tenor under Article 54(1A) of the Ukrainian Criminal Code, that is, for treason to his motherland, the Ukraine. And at his interrogation, the poor fellow couldn't prove that treason to the Ukraine had not been his purpose when he went to Vienna. And that's how he conned his way into becoming a traitor. One important additional broadening of the section on treason was its application via Article 19 of the Criminal Code, via intent. In other words, no treason had taken place, but the interrogator envisioned an intention to betray, and that was enough to justify a full term, the same as for actual treason. True, Article 19 proposes that there be no penalty for intent, but only for preparation. But given a dialectical reading, one can understand intention as preparation. And preparation is punished in the same way, that is, with the same penalty as the crime itself, Criminal Code. In general, we draw no distinction between intention and the crime itself, and this is an instance of the superiority of Soviet legislation to bourgeois legislation. A.Y. Vyshinsky, editor, From Prisons to Rehabilitative Institutions, a collection of articles published by the Criminal Policy Institute, Moscow, Sovetskoye Zakonodedteltstvo Publishing House, 1934. Section 2 listed armed rebellion, seizure of power in the capital or in the provinces, especially for the purpose of severing any part of the USSR through the use of force. For this, the penalties ranged up to and included execution, as in every succeeding section. This was expanded to mean something which could not be explicitly stated in the article itself, but which revolutionary sense of justice could be counted on to suggest. It applied to every attempt of any national republic to act upon its right to leave the USSR. After all, the word force is not defined in terms of whom it applies to. Even when the entire population of a republic wants to secede, if Moscow is opposed, the attempted secession will be forcible. Thus, all Estonian, Latvian, Lithuanian, Ukrainian, and Turkestan nationalists very easily received their tens and their 25s under this section. Section 3 was assisting in any way or by any means a foreign state at war with the USSR. This section made it possible to condemn any citizen who had been in occupied territory, whether he had nailed on the heel of a German soldier's shoe or sold him a bunch of radishes. And it could be applied to any citizeness who had helped lift the fighting spirit of an enemy soldier by dancing and spending the night with him. Not everyone was actually sentenced under this section because of the huge numbers who had been in occupied territory. But everyone who had been in occupied territory could have been sentenced under it. Section 4 spoke about, fantastic, aid to the international bourgeoisie. To whom, one wonders, could this possibly refer? And yet, broadly interpreted, and with the help of a revolutionary conscience, it was easy to find categories. All émigrés who had left the country before 1920, that is, several years before the code was ever written, and whom our armies came upon in Europe a quarter century later, in 1944 and 1945, received 10 years or execution. What could they have been doing abroad other than aiding the international bourgeoisie? In the example of the Young People's Musical Society already cited, we have seen that the international bourgeoisie could also be aided from inside the USSR. They were, in addition, aided by all SRs or Mensheviks, the section was drafted with them in mind, and subsequently by the engineers of the State Planning Commission and the Supreme Council of the Economy. Section 5 was inciting a foreign state to declare war against the USSR. A chance was missed to apply this section against Stalin and his diplomatic and military circle in 1940 to 1941. Their blindness and insanity led to just that. Who, if not they, drove Russia into shameful, unheard-of defeats, incomparably worse than the defeats of Tsarist Russia in 1904 or 1915. Defeats such as Russia had never known since the 13th century. This book is continued on Cassette 3, Side 1.